I Am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the most talked about books, not just in the English language, especially in its original German, is Blitz, Drugs in the Third Reich. Norman Ohler is its author, and he joins me now. In the book, he reveals that despite the Nazis railing against moral degeneracy, the Third Reich was replete with drugs. We learn about the use of drugs like cocaine, heroin, morphine, methamphetamines, among others. Hitler's own use of drugs is chronicled through the drugs administered by his physician, Dr. Theodor Morell. Norman Ohler is a best-selling author, novelist, and screenwriter. This book has been published in over 25 languages. Visit normanohler.de for more. This book is an Allen Lane book, which is an imprint by Penguin. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Norman Ohler. Mr. Ohler, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So this book began as a novel. I'm wondering, as you're writing this, are you thinking to yourself that this is unbelievable, I couldn't come up with this myself?
Well, when I started doing the research, especially in the Federal Archives, reading the notes by Morell, Hitler's doctor, I realized that there's nothing to invent here, that the actual story that happened is more interesting than fiction. That's when I decided to write a nonfiction book about the topic.
And I guess you were given the heads up by, was it a DJ that had known about drug use in Nazi Germany?
Yeah, that was a friend of mine who has a friend who works in clearing out old apartments, and while doing so, he found an old medicine cabinet from the 40s with a drug called Pevitine in it, and my friend the DJ read the package, and it said that it contains methamphetamine, and he told me this story, and that's what got me interested.
Yeah, and so how did you get come across the notes of Dr. Morell?
Well, his notes are all kept in the Federal Archives, so you basically have to just go to the archive and request to see the notes, and then the archivist will hand them to you, and you can start studying.
And so had historians heretofore, had they turned a blind eye to Morell?
Basically, yes. There has been a biography on him that appeared in Germany in the 60s, but a very bad one. Historians have not really understood the crucial role that that he plays in the inner circle.
And so he's brought on to treat Hitler, but what year was that?
Oh, the two men met in 1936 through a patient of Morell, Hubertus Hoffmann, who was the photographer of Hitler, and Hoffmann was very pleased with the way Morell treated him, so he said, I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, and the friend was Hitler, and Hitler complained of stomach problems, stomach cramps, pain that his former doctors had not been able to cure him from, and Morell apparently was able to cure him very quickly, and then also very quickly became the personal physician, and from 1936 all the way to the end of the war, Hitler and Morell basically spent every day together.
Yeah, it's fascinating how you chronicle their relationship, and I'll ask you about that in just a sec. But in terms of what ailed Hitler physically, you mentioned these stomach cramps and the sort. I mean, because later on we find out that he might have been suffering from Parkinson's. Your book doesn't say conclusively whether that's the case. But, I mean, what were some of the things that Hitler was contending with physically?
I mean, basically, we have to say that Hitler was quite a healthy person. He wasn't really sick, especially if you compare it or if you take into account that Morell gave him over 90 different medicines, gave him daily injections, sometimes two injections a day. It's rather strange because Hitler was never really sick. I mean, at one point he had the Russian flu that was in August 1941, and he had to stay in bed while important military decisions had to be taken, and he couldn't go to the military briefing. That's when he requested Morell to give him something that would get him out of bed, and that's the first time when he receives an opioid, a half-synthetic opiate called Optalidone, and it actually gets him out of bed and gets him into the briefing room, and from that moment on we see more and more heavy medication being administered. So Hitler didn't really need usually didn't need drugs because mm-hmm. he was ill. He needed and used drugs so he would not get ill. He basically mm-hmm. used them prophylactically.
Yeah, and so does he know at any point that he's addicted?
Well, when he fires Morel at the end of April 1945, witnesses in the bunker say that he yelled at Morel, you have been giving me opiates the whole time. So that seems to point towards a realization what had actually been going on. Hitler, on the other hand, was quite knowledgeable about medication. So he must have known that if you take a heavy opioid such as Oicodal, which he took, which today is marketed as or branded as OxyContin, I think, mm-hmm. in America, if you take that intravenously in a high dosage every other day, you will get addicted. He might have suppressed that knowledge, but he certainly knew what he was receiving.
And so the book is also careful in that it Hitler's drug use doesn't explain his behavior, and we can't blame his drug use, I should say, on his behavior. But the drugs that he was addicted to, how much of that contributed to his delusion?
Well, I would say the delusion starts in the 20s when he thinks he's the Führer and develops his racist theories in his book, Mein Kampf, My Struggle. And at the time, he was not using drugs, so this really comes out of his delusional ideology, his ideology of hatred towards Jews and hatred towards Slavs and Russians.
Mm-hmm.
But we can see that he later on, he actually starts using massive amounts of drugs in 43 and especially in 44. This is when his goals are already set in concrete, basically. And we can see that he uses these euphoric-making opioids in order to stay on track, in order to keep his tunnel vision of hatred. So we cannot really blame, or we cannot blame at all, the drugs for his ideology, but we can see how he instrumentalized drugs in order to be able to keep functioning when the rest of his entourage, especially the generals, would tell him to change tactics on the Eastern Front.
So knowing what we know now, what does that explain or inform our understanding of the war? I mean, does the drug use, say, affect the outcome of the war at all?
Well, in Blitzed, I especially try to examine how the German Wehrmacht, the German army, was the first army in the world to use a very powerful stimulant in very high quantities, and mm-hmm. that stimulant is methamphetamine. Today we can see that modern armies are using stimulants in order to enhance their fighting capabilities. The Nazis were the first ones to do so. And in their very successful and surprisingly successful campaigns in the West, in May 1940, when they were able to conquer France within a short period of time, 35 million dosages of this methamphetamine were being applied, especially by the tank troops who were racing forwards and who were applying also a very new strategy, the strategy to go through the Ardennes Mountains without stopping, without sleeping for several days and nights. And this was only possible because of the systematic usage of methamphetamine. So certainly the outcome of the war would have been different without the use of drugs. How different, we don't know. That's speculation. But applying methamphetamine was crucial to applying that strategy of racing through the Ardennes Mountains and catching the British and French defenders by total surprise.
The Islamic State and the terrorists in that organization today, are they under the influence, if you will?
Well, while I was in Pakistan at one point researching something else, I heard that, for example, the Taliban are using amphetamines, and there were rumors after the Paris attacks that the IS was using Captagon, which is an amphetamine mass-produced in, I believe, Tunisia. But I have not seen any documents, so these are tales that I have heard. It wouldn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
I have also heard tales from American drone pilots that they use amphetamines, from American Air Force pilots that they use amphetamines, and from ground troops in the first Iraq war that they were using amphetamines. So in a way, it seems to have proven itself that amphetamines, or methamphetamine, as the Nazis used it, unfortunately, are a tool for warriors to sharpen their alertness and reduce their fear and increase their capability to kill other people.
Yeah, and then we've learned, obviously, over the years, the experience in Vietnam, American troops using drugs there.
Also a drug war, yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the photographer that Hitler had around him was being treated by Morel. How much drug use was there amongst the other folks around Hitler in the inner circle? Was that prevalent?
It really depends on the individual. I mean, in general, which is the big irony of the story, is that of course that the Nazis were against drugs.
Mm-hmm.
To the outside world, they were shown as, and presented themselves as clean cut. Hitler was a vegetarian. He was abstinent, teetotaler, and didn't drink alcohol and didn't drink coffee. The reality, of course, especially with Hitler, was different, and it was different also with some of the other guys. For example, Goebbels became a patient of Morel and was using morphine quite a bit. Goering was a morphine addict, in fact. Himmler, on the other hand, as far as I could see, did not use drugs at all. Therefore, he did 2 hours of yoga each morning in his office with his private yoga teacher. But mostly, they were on something. Especially the generals in the Wehrmacht were quite a few of them were either methamphetamine or opioid abusers.
And this package that your a friend of a friend found.
Yeah.
From the Nazi era, does that suggest that drugs were prevalent amongst, say, the German society?
Well, that's how it started. I mean, when the Nazis took over power, they criminalized all drug use. But in 1937, a company in Berlin called Temmler, which still exists, by the way, developed this methamphetamine and branded it as Pevitine. And Pevitine came onto the market in 1938. Perfectly legal, you didn't even need a prescription for it. You could buy it at any chemistry, any pharmacy. It became very popular. It was even mixed into chocolate. The brand was called Hildebrand. It contained 13 milligrams of pure meth in one little piece of chocolate. So in the beginning, it was the civilian population who made methamphetamine really popular and really known. Also, the army only realized that there's a drug out there that combats fatigue and reduces fear and increases self-confidence because it was such a massive consumption in the civilian population. So it was not a top-down approach. It wasn't like the dictator would tell you have to take methamphetamine.
Right,
it was
a
bottom-up approach. People were finding this stuff and finding it useful to function in the performance-driven modern society that was the Nazi dictatorship.
One of the fascinating things that you uncover in the book, and it's great to read, is this relationship between Hitler and Dr. Morel. Was Morel Jewish at all? Did he have relatives that were Jewish?
There were rumors relating to that, but I don't think so. At least my research shows that, or has shown that these are actually just rumors. But in 1933. Someone smears Jew on the front door of his doctor's practice, and that actually leads him to join the Nazi party because he thinks that way he will be protected, and he moves office, and I don't think he was a Jew.
No. So the nature of the relationship, I mean, a patient and a doctor, obviously, you know, there's a level of trust involved. How much trust did Hitler have in Morel?
Oh, he had complete trust. He mistrusted all his other his previous doctors because they were rational, thinking experts who requested of him to that he would be examined by them. They wanted him to undress. They basically wanted to look inside of him or really understand him and would give him the drugs that or the medicines that he would actually need. And he didn't like that. He didn't want a doctor to actually know that much about him. Morel was a very different type of man. He was more the friend doctor that he never really examined Hitler thoroughly. He was talking to Hitler, asking him, how are you doing? He was more maybe like a therapist. And Hitler said, well, I have a very important speech to give. I think a flu is coming on. What do you think we should do? And then Morel would say, well, let's take a heavy opioid, which is, the medicines he gave were like, in German we say, we're shooting with cannons at sparrows. So that's what he did, and Hitler liked that, and Hitler liked to receive these powerful injections by him, which made him immediately feel great and euphoric. So this was a very different type of doctor. It was a Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah. And so how often would they see each other?
Well, I mean, Morel was always with him. When Hitler appointed him personal physician, Morel's wife complained. She said to him, we don't need that. We have a well-going practice in Berlin. If you would take this position, I won't be spending much time with you in the future. And that's exactly what happened. Hitler didn't let him go away. Even when Morel's brother died, Hitler wanted to prohibit Morel to attend the funeral because he said, what will I do if you're gone for 2-3 days? Who will give me my daily injections? Because Morel was very good with injections, and Hitler got used to these daily injections. He didn't want to open himself up to another doctor saying, I want my opioid injection. So he was, in a way, Morel became a sort of prisoner of Hitler, but you could also say that Hitler became dependent on Morel, so they formed a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. You mentioned that he was fired later on. How does that relationship unravel?
Well, I read in Goebbels' diary, I think it was an entry in February or March 1945, where Goebbels says, maybe the many injections that Morel is giving to the Führer are not really beneficial to the Führer's health. Mm. And this was certainly the case. And we can also see that in those last weeks in the bunker in Berlin, Morel runs out of the drugs that Hitler loves. The big pharmaceutical companies have been destroyed by the British. Mm-hmm. For example, Merck Company has been bombed in December 1944. They produce Oikodal. Morel sends two of his aides on motorcycles through Berlin from pharmacy to pharmacy. Berlin's bombed. They don't find any. They actually have to go to pharmacies to get those drugs. This is how it always worked. They had one pharmacy in Berlin where Morel would always go, but this pharmacy had ran out of supplies of the drugs that Hitler really appreciated. So Morel had made him addicted to certain types of substances and suddenly cannot supply them anymore. This is the classic case. The one big mistake the dealer should not make is to make someone hooked on something and then suddenly be unable to supply what is being asked and what is needed. So yeah, the relationship turns sour, and Hitler becomes very irritated towards in these last weeks, basically towards everybody, with some very few exceptions, and Morel also falls out of favor.
And so what becomes of him after the war?
Well, he's being found in southern Bavaria. He takes one of the last planes out of Berlin to southern Bavaria, where he's somewhat safe. He seems to have somehow lost his mind, because in late April 1945, he still tries to file his tax report and sends that off to Berlin, where obviously the tax man is not working anymore.
Yeah.
And in mid-May 45, a reporter from the New York Times finds him and interviews him. A story in the New York Times appears about him in May, and after that story appears, he's being interrogated by American Secret Service, actually held for over a year in a facility in Germany, in occupied Germany then, occupied by the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's released in the summer of 1946 in very ill health and dies 2 months later on, basically a broken man that is never able to restart his life after Nazi Germany collapsed.
Yeah. How much easier is it to write a book like this, Norman, especially now, knowing how our understanding of drugs has changed as opposed to, say, 50 years ago?
Well, 50 years ago, or even 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, for sure, historians did not look at this angle. They, first of all, historians are not really, usually not knowledgeable about drugs. This is changing. I just attended a World War II conference in New Orleans, and there was another scholar from the University of Aachen who was working on how did medicines change or influence the German army and World War II to that extent, to that respect. So I think the historical sciences are changing, and they are, you know, learning new ways of examining what is happening, and it took some time for drugs to come into focus.
Yeah, and you know, this book did well in Germany. It's not done well around the world, but in Germany it was a huge hit. What do you think Germans were wanting to find out, say, for themselves in through your book?
Well, in fact, it hasn't been a bigger hit in Germany than, for example, in the UK. More people actually liked it in the UK and in the United States.
Really?
It found more readers, but also it found readers in Germany because Germans obviously are interested in their history, and this apparently is a fresh angle that gives people a deeper understanding of what happened. But it was also popular in Estonia or in Brazil or in Denmark, so that there seems to be a great interest worldwide in World War II because it affected the lives of so many people, and it affects our lives still today. And to understand better what happened, I guess, is interesting for many people.
And the book also got a negative response from some folks. And I'm wondering if you think that some of that is rooted in the fact that you aren't a historian and that you'd written novels previously.
Well, I mean, what I had not understood before is that the historical sciences are a sort of shark pool, and there's some sharks are in that pool for a long time, and they're trying to guard who else is allowed to swim in that pool, because basically it's about influence and it's about money, it's about selling books. So some historians have reacted with jealousy. And while other historians, for example, Sir Ian Kershaw, the leading Hitler biographer, has reacted very positively, or Sir Anthony Beaver. So it's a mix. In my mind, open-minded historians love the book, and the sharks, the gatekeepers who want to keep new people out, they have to hate it.
Yeah, most of them are academics as well, and so it threatens their livelihood in terms of their standing, I guess, in academia.
Well, and they have basically worked in this field for all of their lives, and they have missed what I think is a crucial point. So you either react very positively and you're very happy. For example, Hans Mommsen, an elderly leading historian on National Socialism in Germany, was extremely interested in my findings and helped me and supported me. And she just said, we have missed this all these decades, and this is a missing puzzle piece. While other historians, they don't want to admit that maybe they have missed something.
You told the New York Times last year that writing this book for you was a liberating experience, because I guess your father was quite reserved, and you understood his relationship with his father a little bit better as a result. And I guess for people reading that, it sort of fulfilled a stereotype that a lot of us had about Germans being reserved.
Well, I mean, it's hard to get stories out of those grandfathers. I tried. I spoke to one of them. The other one died when I was two, and he didn't really talk about it. So in a way, you have to do your own research. You have to go into archives. I actually found stuff about my grandfather in the archives. I mean, he was just a small wheel in the big game, but I actually did find the units where he was at, which my father hadn't known, because he never really talked about it. But I guess they really experienced horrible things, and they just thought they can't really relate that in oral. In a conversation, I guess there's also different examples. But my grandfather was rather reserved about that, and the little bits that he told me were not really satisfying me and not really giving me a lively story. So there was something, you know, a blind spot somehow in my ancestry that somehow maybe I have covered now in Blitz.
Yeah, and so you, as I mentioned, you know, you found it a liberating experience. Are you then an exemplar of say, a change in German society today?
Can you ask that again? I didn't understand.
Yeah, did you find that because it was a liberating experience for you, and I mean, I'm sitting here talking to you, I think I can ask you anything about your life.
Yeah.
Do you think that you're of a generation now that's changed German society as to how they are with themselves and especially with relatives, say, or family relations?
Well, German society certainly changed in regards to the horrible past after the German reunification, and even more so after the Soccer World Championship. I believe it was 2006 in Germany, when suddenly Germans were daring to fly their flag again, which was a taboo. While I grew up, you would never ever fly a German flag, because that would in a way mean that you say yes to the crimes that were committed in the name of Germany. So this is slowly changing, and I think it's probably healthy that it is changing, that a sort of healthy patriotism is again allowed in Germany, and this probably has to do with our generation, the third generation, who's not so closely connected to the horrors. I mean, my father, the second generation, was obviously more closely connected because he was born in 43 when the war was still going on. So, and the fourth generation, I mean, my children, they will have an even more distanced relationship to it, which hopefully will not mean that they don't know anything about it. I mean, maybe my generation has the right balance. We know a lot about it, but we try to keep an open mind about it, and maybe that results in books or treatments that hadn't been possible before.
I guess it's possible that they won't be burdened by it.
Excuse me?
The future generation won't be burdened by the past as much.
Probably not, which is the danger that they might not care at all.
Right.
And I think it's very important in Germany and in any country to be aware of the past and to also be aware of things that went wrong. So I hope that future generations will still read historical books.
Yeah. Are you working on another historical book now, or are you back to novels?
Well, I just published my new novel in Germany, which is set in the 18th century. It's a murder mystery. But now I'm actually working on a new nonfiction book, which is set in the so-called Third Reich, and it's about a young couple who decides to go into the resistance and try to do something against dictatorship.
Well, Blitz is a fascinating book, and until the next one, we'll urge people to read this one. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
The book is called Blitz, Drugs in Nazi Germany. It's an Allen Lane book, which is an imprint of Penguin. Its author, Norman Oler, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plotkin.